This is London Calling.
Welcome to the programme. I'm Graham Mack, and my guest this week is musician, singer, songwriter and producer Peter Frampton. We talk about the early part of his career and also the business challenges facing songwriters in the 21st century.
Since streaming has been on the go here, from Pandora only, they had a figure of 56 million streams of Baby I Love Your Way, and I got $3,000.
That's all?
That's all, yes. 56 million streams.
More from Peter Frampton later, but first of all, here's what's been happening in Britain this week, and it's not been a good week. We've had a couple of tragedies to deal with. In the most recent one, a man drove a van into a crowd of Muslim worshippers in Finsbury Park, London. One man is dead, and nine others are seriously injured. A few days before that, we had a horrific fire in a tower block. It was social housing in West London. 79 people are dead or still missing. Residents and neighbours of the victims are not happy. They've been talking about the way the disaster was handled, the way it was reported, and the response from the local authorities.
Keep here, over here, right here. Eight, nine bodies on the floor.
Yeah,
over here. Nine bodies. So what they done?
Look,
they closed that bit off there.
They're hiding stuff. You know why? I've got a friend who works for the fire brigade here in Labrogrove, yeah? Yesterday on the phone, he said they found about 42 bodies in one room, all hiding together. No one knows that. It's only because we know the brother, he's a fireman. That he told us this.
But he can't tell you.
He can't tell you. He can't come out and tell you that. He can't come out because you'll probably get the sack or something. Yeah. But they said they found 42 bodies in one room, from children to old people. Do you understand? But they're not going to tell you that. Look, I'll tell you this straight, yeah? There's about 42 families that we know that live in there that have gone. So imagine the rest. And these are because we know them because they're Moroccan.
Yeah, we know them, yeah.
Because they're Moroccan like us. That's why we know them.
They come to the youth centre,
the families come to the mosques and that. That's why we know. But they're not telling you all that. They're not telling you the truth.
But you know what they said?
And that's the worst thing about it, not having the truth.
Said everyone there, no one died by getting burned. Everyone died first because of the smoke. Inhaling the smoke. We've got one of our family, the girl, they rang her out, they took her to the hospital. She's in a coma, yeah, because of the smoke. One of them, they started blood coming out from her nose. Yeah, blood coming out from her nose.
If you don't want the real story, you have to go to the people that live here and know people.
And we was here in the beginning.
Do you understand? You've got to go to the people that were coming out of the mosque and running up the building and the police stopping them from going up the building. And yet they still went up there and got people out. You understand? There was disabled people. There's disabled people on the highest floors. You need to know
when
they live here.
When we brought out the disabled guy, what's called, it was him, his wife, and his three kids. He came out, he was disabled. He said, I don't know how I made it from the other floor. We came out, we took him to the rugby club. After that, they put him in a hotel. We went to see him in the hotel. He said, they've given us no food, no water, no clothes, no water, nothing for 2 days until we went there and we gave him
some stuff. Do you want to hear something else funny? You know the water on the top floor stopped working. There was no water on the top floors, you know that? Because why? Everyone's trying to open water to wet up the towels.
Yeah.
Because everyone's doing it, there was no water coming to the top.
Yeah.
So people had no water at the top. You open the taps and there was no water coming out. Everyone was saying it. For you to get the proper and the real stories, you must go to the people that live here. Do you understand? And know people
not
that...
the BBC and Sky.
Yeah, forget
lying.
That.
They're lying.
Honest to God, I swear they're lying. Because I've been watching it on the news.
Who's there in the beginning?
Do you understand? And what they're saying on the news and what you're seeing down here...
Two different stories.
You've got to go to the people that live here or have their families and loved ones that have been lost in there. Do you understand? They're the people that are going to tell you the truth because the rest ain't going to tell you the truth. They don't even know what's going on half of the people. Don't get me wrong. They just come for their condolences and all that. We appreciate that. But you've got to speak to the people who've lost family in there and friends and loved ones. You know what I mean? That's the people you got to speak to. Look, private ambulance. You know what that means, innit? Look, there's a private. You know what that? That's a coroner. You know what that is? That's the coroner's ambulance. Do you understand? They're not telling you how many people.
And
really
what they
died
said now?
It.
What's going to be left? There's only bones. It's going to take a long time to investigate what's going to do the person and stuff like that. Only bones. Yeah, identify.
And they're telling me for £2 extra, which would have cost £5,000 all in total for the new for fire resistant cladding. For the whole building, just an extra £5,000. And you know, to put a sprinkler system in, it would have cost £200,000. They gave him 10 million to do that. So, and they only spent eight million or something like that. So where's the 2 million go? Someone's pocket.
Like I said, if this building here was in Chelsea or Knightsbridge, it's a different situation. If this same building here was in Canary Wharf, sure, and you lot know,
because poor people live here,
they could have went out like that. They would have put the cladding in Canary Wharf like that. Definitely not Canary Wharf, not Chelsea, not Knightsbridge.
I see a picture over there of a helicopter. Yeah, honest to God, a helicopter. It's not. He said it's not here in this city. There's a helicopter with water coming out of it.
Why wasn't it used here? Why wasn't it used here?
We're London, bro. This is London, you know.
And got helicopters with water coming down.
You got a fireman and he's spraying, and it's not even reaching half of it.
Nothing. It was reaching nothing.
It was a joke. If you would have seen it, you would have been. It's got to be more than this. You need more than this.
We're in the UK, man. We're in the UK. Come on, man.
And in London, bruv. And in the richest borough in the UK.
In Europe. They said Europe. This is the richest borough.
Let me tell you about something about this borough. This borough here, if you're broke, if you ain't got enough money, this is what they do to you. Like what they've done to us. They ship you out to Barking and Dagenham and outside Ilford and them places there. You understand? That's what they do. At the moment, this is my borough, but I don't even live in this borough because they ship me out. Yeah, they're getting all the poor people out of here. That's what they do, bro. That's what they do. Because we can't pay. We need the subsidies to pay for the rent. Do you understand? We need government subsidies to pay for the rent. Because that we're them type of people, innit? They said that building was an eyesore. My whole life I lived here, bruv. It wasn't an eyesore to me. I never saw it as an eyesore. We played here football all my life in the West Way and that. That was no eyesore. They made it look nice for the rich people when they drive past. It don't have to be a sore on the eye. You understand? And that's not fair.
I don't usually agree with Katie Hopkins, but in an article she's written in the Daily Mail, she's spot on. She points out that in the Grenfell Tower Block fire, some of London's poorest people burned to death in one of Britain's richest boroughs, and someone was to blame. About 600 people were crammed into these flats. Six flats to a floor, 24 stories high. Maximum capacity dwellings with minimum possibility of escape. They were told to stay inside, told to use wet towels to blot the smoke from the door when they were begging for help to get out. The agreed evacuation policy was to stay put. Onlookers were forced to watch the horror of small children crying for their mothers, parents pleading for help, one mother throwing her baby into the night, hoping arms would catch the baby's fall. There was no care for those on the inside. The new cladding on the building was for the benefit of the outside world looking in. Inside, there was no alarm, no sprinklers. No exit routes, no hope. Now there'll be investigations, recriminations, people will try to explain it away, to distance themselves from the problem, to shirk the accountability that they were paid to accept. Maybe someone will lose their job. Maybe Robert Black, the CEO of the Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation, who, by the way, is paid £140,000 a year. Multiple sackings won't be enough. This is corporate manslaughter on a scale we've never seen in our lifetime. Someone is responsible for this. Someone needs to go to jail. News this week that 250,000 Brits have admitted to having cosmetic surgery. Yet more and more people are having cosmetic surgery, but even more people are admitting. A lot of people were doing it on the sly, but more people are admitting to having it done. Daphne, what have you had done?
Nothing. I don't need it.
Now you say nothing. Say nothing.
No, I haven't had anything.
Okay, well,
I've had operations.
Okay, I'm talking about cosmetic surgery. Now, I would include tattoos. I think that's cosmetic surgery. You got any tats?
No, I haven't either.
Okay. I bet I can find a cosmetic procedure you've had. Okay, let's see. Have you got PSDs?
yes.
Cosmetic surgery! Cosmetic surgery! That's what that is. It's not a knife, it's a needle, but it's still cosmetic. It's elective surgery. You didn't need to have it done. It was purely cosmetic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in the club, Daphne.
You had cosmetic surgery.
I have had nothing done. I don't have any tattoos. I don't have any piercings.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because I have this rule, no pain, no pain.
Oh, you're in an actual fact.
Yeah, what you've got is what you've got.
Yeah.
But, oh, no, hang on. No, wait. I had my teeth whitened.
There you go, then, cosmetic surgery.
Oh, thanks a lot, Daphne. Our Prime Minister is a recluse. Theresa May avoids the public and especially journalists at all costs. During the election campaign, she even refused to show up to the televised debates. They went ahead without her. She hardly ever leaves number 10 Downing Street. The day of the horrific Tower Block fire in London, which started at 1 a.m, she wasn't seen or heard from till 6 o'clock that night. And that was in a short, controlled piece she did from inside number 10. The Tower Block was only a couple of miles away. But she stayed home. It was days later when our invisible Prime Minister left Downing Street briefly to visit the site of the Grenfell Tower Block fire. She met with emergency services personnel and then went back home without talking to any press. The only photos I've seen from her visit look like they were taken on a long lens from a helicopter. She didn't even meet any of the victims and survivors of the fire. Meanwhile, the Mayor of London and the Leader of the Opposition were on site talking to journalists and hugging people who'd been affected. Once again, it wasn't until she was safely back inside Downing Street that she made a statement to what looked like one invited journalist in front of one camera. What's going on here? Theresa May has become the Julian Assange of Downing Street.
Hi there, my name's Karen.
Hello, Karen. What can I do for you?
I wanted to say thank you to all my neighbours for all their donations for the Grenfell Tower fire.
So you're collecting for them?
I'm feeling quite emotional about it, actually. I just sent a note round to all my neighbours yesterday and said to them, if you bring all this stuff around to my house, I'll deliver it to one of the pickup points for you. Thank you to everybody that's done this, all my neighbours.
What kind of stuff did they give you?
I didn't go rummaging through everybody's bags, but from what I could see, there were toiletries and sanitary items, there were clothes, there were toys for children, teddy bears. I'd seen colouring books and packets of colouring pencils and shoes.
Brilliant. And Karen, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Brexit is already going badly for Britain. The talks to take us out of the EU have started and the UK is backpedaling already. On the first day, the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, conceded to EU demands by agreeing to a two-phase negotiation. It means the divorce terms will be set first before discussions on trade relations. Mr. Davis had previously said that not setting both elements together would be, and I quote, the row of the summer. Well, it looks like he's decided that the easiest way to avoid a row is to just give in on day one. These negotiations are set to take 2 years. And I don't know why we're calling these meetings talks. David Davis is making out that we're actually going to negotiate here. We're not. In a negotiation, the person that gets the best deal is the one who's prepared to walk away. But we can't walk away. We had a referendum. There's a mandate from the people. Britain has already decided to leave the EU. If we want to get out, the EU will tell us what it's going to cost. And we'll just have to accept that deal. We don't have a plan B. No alternative to a negotiated agreement. It's not negotiation. We're going to have to do whatever the EU say and pay whatever the EU say we have to pay. If you're looking for the perfect metaphor here, you don't have to look much further than the ceremonial gifts that were exchanged at the beginning of these so-called talks. David Davis gave Michel Barnier, who represents the EU, a book about mountaineering. And Mr. Barnier presented Mr. Davis with a walking stick. What does that mean, do you think? Did Britain's gift show that we have a mountain to climb? And what about the EU's gift? A walking stick. Does that show that we're hobbling into these talks? Or were they showing us the big stick they're going to hit us with? Weird stuff people take on planes. A survey is out by the flight comparison company jetcost.co.uk. Airport security workers have been revealing some of the weirdest things that Brits have taken on planes. Some of them are truly bizarre. Among the strange items found in people's luggage, there's a jar of sheep's eyeballs, a suitcase full of mannequin hands, and £100,000 worth of Monopoly money. Jane, you want to talk about something? You got onto a plane.
Yeah, in a war zone.
Where?
Kashmir. I was in Kashmir, quite a lot of years ago, probably 29 years ago. I was in Kashmir on a houseboat on Lake Dal when General Zaire's plane got shot down. And Kashmir became a war zone.
Yeah.
And we were the last people to leave the area.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually under curfew on the houseboat for 3 days. Armed guard, etc., etc., etc. Because, like, it became, you know, it started blowing Western people up.
Wow.
And we were hustled onto a coach when it was deemed safe enough to get us out of the city, out of Srinagar, which was the town, near where the airport was. And I think, actually, we were on the last plane to leave. So we were put on this coach. No joking, we drove through the city. We were laying on the floor with soldiers stood over us with machine guns. We had to lie on the floor. They were lobbing hand grenades around in the city around us. We could hear it all.
Wow.
Got to the airport. I have never seen security. It wasn't massively technological like it is now, probably because of the area and partly because of the times.
Yeah.
And I had my little Gladstone kit bag full of the flotsam and jetsam that I had acquired on a 2 or 3 week Indian tour. There was weird stuff in there.
Like what?
Oh, there was lots of hand-painted crafts, paper mache things, but there were nothing dangerous, but, you know, like the stuff that you buy when you're in India and you can't, you say, oh, I'm on holiday in India, I'll buy that. Oh, I'll buy that.
Anything with an elephant on it?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Was it proper touristy tat? Did anything have a thermometer on it?
No.
Okay.
I do have standards.
Okay. No snow globes? No.
Okay. You know, Kashmir and India, I couldn't find one.
Well, how about that?
I did buy Kashmiri shawls back.
Okay.
Sold to me by a man who lived in Manchester on top of the Himalayan mountains, which was a little bizarre. But anyway, there
we go. Yes, okay.
So this shot putter of an Indian, I say lady, she had a sari on, but I'm not entirely sure she was a lady.
Okay. All right.
Snapped on the rubber gloves.
Oh, dear.
Did a body search. Not.
Okay.
On the out. We won't go into details.
No.
Emptied my suitcase, and I'm thinking, oh, God, not the dirty washing bag. please, not the dirty washing bag. Oh, no, including the dirty washing bag, all out on the counter. Went through every piece of flotsam and jetsam that I'd bought.
Oh, no.
Took quite a while. I'd bought a lot.
Yeah.
Vaguely put it all back, but not really.
Yes.
I was left to do that.
Yeah.
And I could get on the plane. Having said that, it wasn't the most comfortable journey that I've ever spent on a plane. I'm not hugely fond of flying anyway.
Mm.
But there was a real terrorist threat. I mean, there was a war going on. They actually closed Kashmir down.
Wow.
And it wasn't open to tourists for a long time. I think it is again now, but it's relatively recent.
Yeah.
It was taken very seriously when we were under curfew. We didn't even have proper food.
So I bet, although you had the embarrassment, I bet you were glad that they were being so fussy with what people were taking on the plane.
I wish they'd been fussier. I was hoping that there would be some, like, detecting equipment.
Oh, I see, right.
Not just all manual.
Right.
But
right,
there wasn't. But it was an interesting experience, but it isn't one I'd care to repeat.
Thank you very much, Jane.
All right, Graham.
Cheers.
Cheerio now. Bye.
Bye. Exit signs are in the wrong place. It's hard to imagine the true horror of what people must have been going through in London's Tower Block fire. For the people who were trapped inside that building, it must have been hell. I have never had to find my way out of a burning building, but from what I've heard, the biggest problem is smoke. As well as making it hard to breathe, it makes it hard for you to find your way out because you can't see anything. The closest I've had to having to find my way out of a smoke-filled room is when I had to find my way out of a steam-filled room. I worked as a maintenance contractor at Marsden Point Oil Refinery in New Zealand. One day we got a call saying that when they turned the taps on in the men's toilets in the electrical department, steam came out. So I went down there, I checked it out, and a thermostatic valve had jammed wide open, overheating the hot water. And a relief valve that was supposed to vent excess pressure had failed. I worked out pretty quickly that if this carried on, the tank would explode. So I needed to vent the pressure, and quick. So I just opened all the hot water taps. Well, this toilet room filled with steam, and I had a hard time finding my way out. It was a square room, wasn't complicated, not a series of corridors. And I knew where the door was, because I'd come in through it. But it took me a while to find my way out. Obviously, what I went through is minor compared to being trapped inside a burning building. But the thing I learned is that in a situation like that, exit signs are useless. Because steam, like smoke, fills a room from the top down. Why are all the signs that point towards the nearest exit placed up high? I've seen them above doorways. In a fire, that's the first place that's going to be obscured by smoke. The advice the fire brigade give you is if you're trying to get out of a smoke-filled room is to get down low. All exit signs should be placed on skirting boards or painted on the floor. A story from America has been making the news in Britain this week. It's a story of Katrina Buchman, who thought she'd hit a massive jackpot on the Sphinx slot machine at the Resorts World Casino in Queens, New York. She thought she'd won $42 million. The casino say the machine was faulty, and they've offered her a steak dinner instead. Sarah, you once went through an experience where you thought you'd won big, but it turned out to be not so big. What happened?
I did win a competition once when I was at school. We went to the Ideal Home exhibition. We were in sixth form, wasn't it, on a school trip.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting because Radio Humberside were there.
Right.
And there was a quiz, and I was allowed to take part in the quiz. Oh, your prize will be posted out to you, blah, blah, blah. And I waited literally weeks and weeks and weeks for it to come, and it arrived, and it was a Radio Humberside baseball cap.
And did you live in Humberside at the time?
No.
Where did you live?
Coddicott, in Hertfordshire.
Was it terrorism? The latest attack in London is being called terrorism, but why? Darren Osborne is accused of driving a van into a group of Muslims in Finsbury Park just after midnight on Monday last week. One man was killed, 9 others are recovering at home. Darren Osborne doesn't belong to a terrorist organisation, and as far as we can tell, he worked alone. Surely to be a terrorist, you have to belong to a terrorist group, and there has to be a degree of cooperation. The IRA, well, they were terrorists, and so is ISIS. But Darren Osborne? I don't think so. According to vocabulary.com, the definition of a terrorist attack is a surprise attack involving the deliberate use of violence against civilians in the hope of attaining political or religious aims. Did Darren Osborne have political or religious aims? He's been described by family and friends as a complex and troubled individual, known for flipping his lid when he drank too much. His mother said that he's no terrorist. His sister Nicola denied that her brother is even political. She also said he tried to kill himself a few weeks ago. And it's claimed that he shouted insults at his Asian neighbours. So Darren Osborne is not a terrorist. And this was not a terrorist attack. Darren Osborne is a nutcase. And this was a hate crime. This awful tower block fire in London. When these things happen, you do see the best in people. It's unfortunate that it has to be a tragedy like that that brings out the best. But there are some good people about. One of them is Jamie Wells. He's from Better Removals and Storage in Royston. He wanted to do something about this. And he's been collecting stuff. Let's see if I can get him on the phone now and get an update.
Hello.
How did it go yesterday?
Oh, it went, yeah, it was a crazy day.
Yeah. So
we got a lot of stuff delivered yesterday.
So you had 3 trucks on the road?
We took two lorries and 3 Luton vans.
Oh, wow. So quite the fleet. Did you drive in convoy?
Yes, yeah. Well, we had 3 of us in convoy and then 2 of us coming from different locations. So,
okay, yeah.
We've still got some stuff they couldn't take. They were full, so we've still got some donations that we need to. We're waiting for instructions from the Red Cross.
Okay, right. So where did you take them?
We took them to 177 Kinsale Road in W10.
Is that where they're collecting?
To an old dance studio. Yeah, that's the 6th building, apparently, they've opened.
Oh, there are 6 buildings now full of stuff that people have donated.
Yeah, well, we were put on hold yesterday, so we had to wait until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for an address.
Yeah.
So, and then obviously we went there and there was hundreds of vans there as well.
So there were hundreds of vans there?
Yeah, there was vans literally turning up one after the other, from all over. I don't know. There was just removal firms. They were, just people collecting and donating.
Isn't that fabulous that people have really pitched in to try and do what they can because they realise how desperate the situation is? I mean, people have lost loved ones, obviously, but they've lost everything they own as well.
I know, everything. The traffic wardens waived all parking tickets because we were parked on double yellow line.
Good for them.
We even had one helping us unload our vehicle.
A traffic warden helped you?
Yeah, 100%.
There's been a glitch in the matrix.
I know, I've got a picture as well I can send you.
Isn't that great? And did you meet any of the people down there?
To be honest, there was so much going on, I didn't know who was a volunteer, who was from the Red Cross, but the army were there in force,
right,
on their day off.
Yeah.
Moving all the kids' stuff upstairs, which was great.
Was that an official thing, the army, or did the lads just pitch in?
They're volunteers, apparently. They're all volunteers on their days off and after a night shift.
All right, and what happens now? You've still got some more stuff to deliver. When are you going to do that?
We're going to speak to the Red Cross today, to see whether they've got a new location.
Yeah.
And just to instruct us what to do, basically.
Did they say there's anything in particular, any particular items that that they need?
They didn't personally, but from being there, it seemed to be that it was more the toiletries, the foods, and the kids' items.
That's what they need.
There were so many different, you know, bits of clothing there.
Yeah.
You know, the bedding as well, also the bedding.
Okay, and they need that.
Yeah, that was just my opinion from how I was seeing it there.
And are you still collecting, Jamie?
Well, because London have told us to sort of keep it on hold at the moment.
Okay. Just hold off. All right.
If we could, yes.
And the name of your business?
Better Removals and Storage Limited.
Better Removals and Storage Limited in Royston.
In Royston, yeah.
You're a mighty man, Jamie. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Cheers, mate. Tell her.
Bye-bye.
A story that got a lot of people talking this week came from Russia. A couple of cattle rustlers stuffed a full-size cow in the back of a larder. What's the craziest thing you've ever seen on the road? Danny.
So I'd done the cliche travelling trip last year.
Yeah.
And I spent some time in Vietnam.
Right.
And was in one of the main cities, I think Ho Chi Minh or somewhere. And yeah. I saw this bloke on a moped. And he had an industrial fridge attached to the back of it.
An industrial fridge, so a thing about seven feet high.
Yeah. Not just your standard little fridge, like a full-blown industrial fridge, like horizontally.
So it was sticking out either side, like a big...
Either side, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And was he going all right with it?
Oh, yeah, he looked like he needed stabilising.
He did.
He seemed to be coping, he seemed to be doing all right.
Roger, the Prime Minister's under a lot of pressure right now because she didn't visit any of the victims of the Tower Block fire in London. What do you think of the Prime Minister?
I don't think she's got much go for the country at all, mate.
You really don't?
No. No. She's got no... she's more interested in what she's getting out of it, I think.
Well, it seems that she's more obsessed with this deal she's trying to do with the DUP than she is with the victims of the Tower Block fire in the same city that she lives in. I mean, the day of the fire, she was nowhere to be seen. We didn't hear a peep from her till 6 o'clock at night, and that was from inside Downing Street. And then she only visited the place yesterday, and she didn't do any press. The only photographs we've seen of her with the emergency services people there, which apparently she only spent half an hour with them anyway, was from like a long lens on a helicopter or a drone or something. I don't know why she's behaving like a monarch. She doesn't realize that she's an elected representative of the people and she works for us. But it seems that she's decided she lives in a palace and she only comes out when she feels like it. That's what it looks like to me. I think she's missing a trick. I think she's got bad advisors. You know, isn't somebody saying to her, look, you're making a mess of this. These are the times when you're supposed to step up. You're making a mess of this. People are wondering what the hell's going on with you.
She's queenie. She wants to be queenie.
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. She wants to be queenie. She's the important part. I'm here, I want to be seen, and, you know, that's her.
Yeah, well, that's not how it works when you're the elected Prime Minister of a democracy. That's not how it works.
But she didn't get the results she wanted, did she?
No, she didn't. And I wonder, well, that was the same thing as well. She didn't show up for that either. She didn't show up for the televised debates. She just doesn't show up. And, you know, that's the most important thing about showbiz, which is almost what she's in. She's in a branch of show business, let's face it. You know, most of success is just showing up. Well, she's not showing up.
She's only got enough money for it, mate.
You what?
She's not being paid enough money.
Is that what you reckon?
Well, possibly.
I don't know. I don't know what the motivation is. I think she's running scared at the moment. She's scared of being asked, being put on the spot and being asked an awkward question by a sharp journalist and looking silly. And she keeps firing people. She's fired her advisor. She fired that woman that had a go at her leather trousers. She just fires people. She's a control freak. She's firing people that don't agree with her. And she's just keeping out of the way. I don't like her. Hello, Mick.
You're about the strangest things you've seen on the road.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're driving down this road, and the traffic jam was crazy, and we could hear people bibbing, come up to this roundabout. So we got a little bit further on, and in the middle of this roundabout, there's a stake and a bloke tied to it, completely naked, and it says, getting married in the morning.
Oh,
and
everyone
was bibbing him, and he had all his streamers around his head and everything, and it was, no one near him, he didn't have his mates with him, he was just completely naked, strapped to this post.
They strapped him up and left him. What a mate's for, eh?
And all the traffic was obviously building up, we all slowing down to have a look at him.
Let's get to this week's main guest. It's singer, songwriter and musician Peter Frampton. Up until 1998, his album Frampton Comes Alive, which has sold more than 10 million copies, was the best-selling live rock album in history. He was born in England, but now lives in the USA. Peter Frampton, welcome to London Calling.
Does it ever get aired in England, or it just gets aired over here?
It goes online, so people from England can access it.
Right.
But I also do a show. I do a couple of shows. I do one on Bob FM in the home counties, and I do another show on BBC Radio Merseyside, and I know I'll be using clips of our chat on those shows as well.
Oh, good. And are you from Liverpool?
Originally, yes. Could you tell?
Yes, I could. Yes. I mean, it's very, you know, every 25 miles, there's another accent in England. Here, it's 500 miles, you know?
Yeah.
So it's because, you know, we had to walk or go by horse in those days.
That's right, yeah. And you sound like you've still got a little bit of Kent in there with the American.
Not much. I hate to say it, but it's, you know, I've tried desperately, but you start speaking American because you have to be bilingual, because certain words you use over here, they have no clue what you're talking about. I mean, this is an interesting one. I remember, like they say, if you over here, oh, you fell over. Yeah, I fell on my fanny.
Oh.
Well, fanny over here is butt.
Yes.
Over in England, it's always been the front of a woman.
Yes,
as far as I remember. And I explained this to Americans today, and they were absolutely on the floor laughing. So right there, I'm bilingual, you know.
My favorite story, just quickly, about the word fanny, and I don't even know if it's true. It's probably an urban myth, but you know, we used to have a TV chef called Fanny Craddock. That was her name on TV.
Yes.
Yeah. And she had her husband, Johnny, who used to help her on the TV with the cooking. And I heard a story that apparently Johnny turned to the camera one day and said, well, if you're cooking these at home, I hope your cakes turn out to look just like Fanny's.
Oh, God.
It's probably not even true, but it's a great story.
Yes, exactly.
Hey, Peter, thank you so much. It's an honor to speak to you. This is a show that's for America, but it's based in London. It's called London Calling. So a lot of the people I talk to are Brits who live in America. In fact, I made a list of Brits in America that I'd like to talk to, and you were top of that list. So I'm so glad we managed to get this together.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you for choosing me.
No worries at all. And I want to find out about the new album and the new single. But first, there's a lot of things to cover on the way.
Right.
You've been to Capitol Hill lately. You're a lobbyist. Tell me about that.
Well, obviously, I've been a songwriter for most of my life. And I call it the Napster point in the recording industry changed everything.
Yeah.
And it's been a slippery slope ever since. And for the writer, I'm just talking about the songwriter right now. The songwriter is like the bottom of an inverted triangle. Everybody, if there's not a song, nobody else makes money above him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they all make more than him. But the thing is that now we've got jump forward to everything is streaming now. And that's obviously the way it's going to go. And as my writing partner, Gordon Kennedy, who wrote Change the World for Eric and Babyface, we've been writing together for 18 years. You know, we talk on stage. We've been doing this acoustic tour, which we do twice a year, the Roar Tour. And I explained that we have a new single and you can stream it. And I said, whatever that means. And I said, all I know is you guys, the audience, I mean, you guys pay so much a month. And I look at Gordon, I go, and we get nothing.
Right.
And it's basically very true. It's next to nothing. So I was asked by Paul Williams, who is the president of ASCAP, who is the collection agency that I'm with. There's BMI and ASCAP, are the main two anyway. And he asked, would I be interested in going to Washington to walk the halls and do a little show for the senators and congressmen and women and plead our case. So when we got in front of the congressmen, their jaws dropped when I said this. Since streaming has been on the go here, from Pandora only, they had a figure of 56 million streams of Baby I Love Your Way, and I got $3,000.
That's all?
That's all, yeah. 56 million streams. Their jaws drop. Well, mine did when I was first told that, obviously.
Shadows go so long before my eyes, and they're moving across the page. Suddenly the day turns into night, far away from the city. Don't hesitate, 'cause your love won't wait. Ooh, baby, I love you way. Wanna tell you I love you way. Some firefly. I wonder how they have the power to shine, shine, shine. I can't see them under the pine, but don't hesitate, 'cause you're I love you way. Wanna be with you night and day.
works out to $170 per million streams for the songwriter if you wrote entirely. Otherwise, if you wrote with a couple other people or a partner, you got to split that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's mind-boggling.
Is there hope that you'll get a better deal?
Well, we went there to ask for a couple of different things to be changed. We are the only small business songwriters that are 70% governed by government, by a judge who determines how much the rate is that the songwriter should get. No other small industry is governed. It started in 1908. And in 1908, they had sheet music.
Yeah.
That's all you could get. You couldn't get recordings. Or if you did, it was those cylinders, which came shortly after that. And they set a rate of one penny, American penny, for the songwriter, for the sheet music, for each piece of sheet music. And we gradually got that rate up from one penny to nine pennies. That's where we are right now. That was 1908. So you can see it's way, way behind.
Yeah.
And now that technology has moved so fast and government works and the courts work so slowly, the songwriters right now is, who would want to be a songwriter, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way we're looking at it.
I mean, sales now of physical media are so low. Mm-hmm. I guess it's only the live work that really pays then.
Well, obviously, I'm lucky in as much as that I love to tour. I love to play live. So, yes, that is the other income stream. I mean, it's that you used to go on the road to promote the album. Now you go on the road to go on the road.
Yeah.
You know, at concerts, people buy CDs and things like that. But they are far few and few between. They're going now. They will be disappeared very soon.
Well, good luck with all that. I hope that all works out and you get a better deal for songwriters all over the world. To go back to the beginning then, Peter, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bromley, Kent, 15 miles south of London, just, you know, in suburbia.
And you got into your first band when you were 16, which was the mod band, the Herd.
That was the first professional band, yes.
Now, the live act at the Marquee, you had a set where you did jazz and blues, but you were releasing poppy material. How did that go down?
Well, yes, the Herd were initially more of an R&B-flavored rock band, and we dallied in blues and jazz. Yes, that's true. We played Jimmy Smith numbers, and I played Kenny Burrell, and Andrew Bound played Jimmy Smith, and Andrew Steele was Grady Tate, the Jimmy Smith trio, and we did that at the Marquee Club and had a great following for that, as well as original numbers. But basically, we did covers, you know, at that point, and then Howard and Blakely came along, the writer managers, and started using us to work with Steve Rowland, the record producer, to do demos for some of their other bands, one of them being Dave D. Dozy, Beaky McIntitch. And then they saw what we were like in the studio, and we're a really good band. And so they said they would write us a song, and would we like them to manage us and all that, and we'll have Steve Rowland as the record company. And that's when, of course, they started writing these very successful commercial songs for the Herd. And we went along with it and were very successful. I had three very big singles, obviously, and a very successful album.
Yeah.
some point, we all realized that we were earning a lot more money than we were actually seeing, you know, or the band was generating more money than we were actually taking home, even after you took all the expenses off, you know. And so that's when we sort of repudiated our contracts and went out on our own. And unfortunately, without that family of management, record company and everything, we floundered at that point, which was a shame. But at that point, that was when I was already jamming with Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane down in the country, and they had helped the Herd produce a couple of tracks for the next album, which never happened. It never got released, the second album that we were doing on our own. But that's when I met Steve Marriott, who I've been a huge fan of ever since I'd first seen them, Small Faces, Do What You're Gonna Do About It on Ready, Steady, Go live. And I wanted to be in that band.
Yeah.
Dramatically. I was it. That was the band I wanted to be in. And I almost got my wish. I sat in with the Small Faces more than a couple of times. And then Steve wanted me to join, and the rest of them didn't want me to because they wanted to keep it a trio. And so Steve, in the end, left, and we formed Humble Pie together.
And what age were you then?
18.
Yes, pretty young.
You know, 18, 19. I think I was 18 through 21, I was with Humble Pie.
And Humble Pie were just great. It was a lot heavier. It was like a blues rock influence, almost like a Led Zeppelin with multiple vocalists. Yeah. When you hear it, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun. Was that a fun band to be in?
Absolutely. I mean, we were all just thrilled that we came into the rehearsal every day. And the very first rehearsal in Jerry Shirley's mother's front room was us playing the band numbers, I think. I forget which one we did first, but we were just playing other people music that we loved, that we all liked together. And I remember Dr. John's album, the Grigory album, had just come out, and we found that we all loved that, and the band's first album. And obviously Zeppelin had just recorded their very first album, and that was just coming out as we formed. So we'd heard a little bit of that. But basically, it was the American, it was always American music, you know, that we were very, very interested in. And then obviously got our first release with Andrew Oldham being the manager and the record company Immediate. And we were with them for the first two records until Immediate went broke.
Thank you.
And you left in 71. You left Humble Pie. Why was that?
Well, the thing was that our direction had narrowed. We'd started off, any one of us could come into a rehearsal and say, I've got this riff or this song or this chorus. Do you want to work on it? And we'd all work on it. It didn't matter who it was, you know, Greg, Jerry, Steve, myself. And it was a very open, multiple direction band.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can see that on the first two records. And then when we went to A&M, changed management and record producer, we went from Andy Johns to Glenn Johns. So from brother to brother, Glenn, we signed with A&M, and it was a massive deal for the time. And they said that they would do the deal if we signed, if we used Glenn as producer. And we agreed because we'd all worked with Glenn before, so we'd love that idea. So Glenn sat us down and said, you need to look at your strengths and utilize them. And let's put it this way. Jerry's the drummer. Greg's the bass player, singer sometimes. Peter's the guitar player, singer sometimes. Steve's the guitar player, but he's the lead singer. And we had not thought of it in that way, even though we were always very open to Steve singing anything because he had such a great voice. You know, I would never argue, oh, I want to sing this one. No, that was, you know, it was pretty obvious that the man was the most talented singer in the band and of many bands. And we were just thrilled to be there playing, you know, in the band with him, you know. But he didn't want that. He wanted it to be more of a shared thing. He didn't like the limelight as much as you'd think. So after Glenn said that, our direction narrowed, and I was finding that there were songs that I was writing, and from our tours, we'd realized that the stage act was a lot heavier than maybe some of our records.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really the fact that I couldn't really do what I was used to doing with Humble Pie anymore, and decided that the live album, Rockin' the Fillmore, which I was on and mixed a lot of those tracks with Eddie Kramer, the engineer, that was going to be successful. We didn't know how successful, but we knew it was going to be the demand for us live was far superior to than our audience for buying the records.
Love me, dance up, storm, love.
So we gave them, the idea was to give them what was going the best, which was the live show. And that's what we did. And of course it was, after I left, I thought I'd made the biggest mistake of my life, because it started zooming up the charts all over the place and became our first 500,000 seller in the States, which was our first gold record. And I was back to stage one. Maybe a couple of runs up the ladder due to my success with Humble Pie, but it was back to opening the bill again, whereas Humble Pie moved into the closing spot. And there was a moment or two there where I really didn't know whether I'd made the right decision or not.
Wow. Well, you did, because you there were four solo albums after that. Actually, it wasn't really until the fourth one, was it, the Frampton album, that you really started getting the sales in the US. Were you under pressure from the record company along the way to deliver a hit?
You know, I have to say that it comes from the Humble Pie record deal, that A&M Records were not like any other record company. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of artists and a lot of business people over the years, obviously. Jerry Moss and Herb Albert wanted to make a record company for musicians, not for flash in the pans, as it were. And they wanted long careers with their artists, and they were willing to, as with Humble Pie, me, Supertramp, you know, they were willing to have bands that they would bank on, but over a long period. They weren't, you know, if you had a failure with the first album, it wasn't like today when, okay, you're on the street, you know. They wanted us to go on and build the band's appeal on record, find our own way. They were never demonstrative, apart from suggesting that we use Glyn Johns as the producer engineer, which we had no problem with, because, you know, that was almost a given, you know, because he was so good and is still so good. But no, it was I felt like when you were with A&M, you went to college. It was like the college I never went to, that this wonderful vibe on the A&M lot. Every executive's door was open. You could just walk into Jerry Moss's office and you didn't need an appointment. And it was all for one and one for all. It was a very different business relationship than I'd ever experienced with the record company. They were there to support you. I mean, after four records, thank goodness the Frampton record did start to sell a little bit, because I thought that might have been my last record with them. But we all looked at each other after Frampton. I don't think we said anything. We just nodded and went, yep, it's time to do the live record, just like Humble Pie had. It took them four albums, and then the fifth one was the live record. So it was sort of an unwritten law that the fifth one should be a live one for me, because it was the same thing as far as the audience. And my audience, live audience, was much bigger than my record-buying audience. So that's when we decided to go in and do the live record.
If there was ever a musician who was an honorary member of San Francisco society, Mr. Peter Frampton. We'll be right back.
from Peter Frampton in a couple of weeks' time. In part two, find out how life changed for him after the success of Frampton Comes Alive, how he hit the bottle, and find out what he's up to these days. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back or Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.